The following is a recording of Michael Schiffner presenting The Chaos in Venezuela on December 6th, 2019.
So I want to welcome you to the fifth of 14 Friday morning presentations here for the World Affairs Council. It looks like we've got pretty much a full house. Unfortunately, this week we do not have any high school groups. A couple were invited, but they had other activities ongoing and they weren't able to attend. So it's all yours. I want to do a couple things before we introduce the speaker. And the first is to mention that in about a month, we have the first of four evening speaker series presentations. Those are going to be held at the Soundwaves facility near the Coligny Circle area. And the first presentation is going to be by Bing West, who is a part-time island resident, and he co-wrote Jim Mattis's recent book on leadership and loyalty. So he will be presenting in January at Soundwaves. Sign-ups for that are going fairly well. We can still accommodate a few people for the full series and a few additional people for that particular event. But we are approaching the ceiling on the number of people we can accommodate. And now for kind of a sad event, we're saying goodbye today to two longtime board members, Margaret McManus and Lee Wilwerding. Lee has been president for a number of years. Margaret has been actively involved for 6 years as well. They're both term limited off, but they're not leaving the island, as far as I know. And I do want to say that they, along with Carlton Dallas, who's also leaving after 6 years on the board, are people who they didn't just make my job easier, they made it possible for an organization to have grown to the size this one has over that period of time. And I'm really gratified to see so many of you here to say farewell to Lee and Ruth. Would you please come up on the stage? And Margaret and Jim. Okay. And and we have a few gifts, Georgia and Ivan. Our two newest board members, Georgia West and Ivan Bennett, have a few things to present as a thank you from us for their many years of making the organization what it is.
So,
thank you very much.
Ruth,
thank you. Margaret, thanks so much.
John,
okay.
It's a pleasure.
And thank you, my dear. And now that the fun part is done, we're about to start learning some really interesting things about one of the more controversial and perhaps volatile areas of the world. Our speaker today will be introduced by Maria Berliner. Maria, I'd like to turn the microphone over to you to introduce Michael.
Mr. Michael Schiffner was director of the Latin American and Caribbean Program at the National Endowment for Democracy. At the Ford Foundation, he was the director of their Democracy and Human Rights Program in the Andean region and in the Southern Cone. As such, he lived in Lima, Peru, and in Santiago, Chile. He represented the Inter-America Foundation in Brazil, and he also worked in the Latin American program of the Wilson Center. Since 1993, he has been professor of Latin American politics at the School of Foreign Service of George Washington University. He has served on the board of the Washington Office on Latin America, also on the advisory committees of Human Rights Watch, the Americas Division, and also at the Association for Latin American Studies, where he is associate editor of the Foundation's Current History Journal. Prior to becoming president of the Inter-American Dialogue, Mr. Shifter was the Dialogue's vice president for policy and also the director of their Democratic Governance Program. Since 1994, Mr. Shifter has been a key player in advising and influencing for the good U.S. policy in Latin America. Under his leadership, the Inter-American Dialogue has become the world's must-go-to think tank for any issue related to Latin America. The Dialogue's analysis, newsletters, panels, conferences, and seminars are required information and first source intelligence for anyone who analyzes Latin America or who is interested in the region. Mr. Shifter writes and lectures widely in the United States, Latin America, and Europe are the leading universities. His most recent publications appear in the Harvard International Review, the New York Times, Foreign Policy, Foreign Affairs, the Washington Post, the Los Angeles Times, the Miami Herald, Current History, and also in newspapers and journals in Nicaragua, Jamaica, Mexico, Panama, Colombia, Peru, Bolivia, Ecuador, Argentina, Chile, and Brazil. He is co-editor of Jorge Dominguez of Creating Democracy in Latin America, published by Johns Hopkins University. He is regularly interviewed on media in Europe, Latin America, the US, and China. As a subject matter expert on Latin America, he appears regularly on CNN and the BBC. Speaking in the sea parlance, he often and regularly goes up the hill. In DC parlance, that means that he regularly testifies before the US Congress about policies to Latin America and the Western Hemisphere. Mr. Shifter holds a master in sociology from Harvard University, where he also taught. To conclude, please join me in welcoming Mr. Michael Shifter. Mr. Shifter. We are honored by your presence.
You're very generous.
Thank you.
Generous.
Thank you.
Can you hear me? Okay. Good morning, everybody, and welcome. Maria, thank you so much for that overly generous introduction. John, thank you so much again for the invitation to be here and the opportunity. It's my first visit to Hilton Head. I've heard a lot about it from a lot of colleagues and friends over the years, but it's such a pleasure to be at this beautiful place. The name of my organization is the Inter-American Dialogue. So, as Maria said, what I look forward to is to hear your questions after I share a few remarks and reflections of my own. Hugo Chavez, who was a despot but very clever at the same time, used to call my organization the Inter-American Monologue. And I don't want to give him any credence to that, so I look forward to hearing from you. I hope you didn't invite me to cheer you up. This is a particularly difficult moment in Latin America, and particularly in Venezuela, which is a case apart from the rest of the region. Many years ago, the New York Times journalist James Reston said that Americans will do anything for Latin America except read about it. These days, however, they seem to be reading quite a bit, and there's concern and even alarm. It's hard to escape the news that's coming from Latin America. It's all over the media. The region is convulsed, on fire, as massive protests have erupted in Chile, Colombia, Bolivia, Ecuador, Haiti, Honduras, and elsewhere. But the biggest surprise has been the protests in Chile, a country that had been assumed by many analysts, including myself, to be the model of stability and social peace. It has the highest per capita income in the region at $25,000 a year. And now it sees sustained and sometimes violent street mobilizations throughout the nation, led by the youth of that country, who are angry and frustrated with political and economic elites. To put Venezuela's crisis in perspective, this Andean and Caribbean nation, with the largest proven oil reserves in the world, was for many years also seen as a model in the region. It was among the richest countries in the world. In the 1970s, the per capita income in Venezuela was higher than Spain, Greece, and Israel. It was the home of many Latin American exiles who fled dictatorships in Argentina and Chile and elsewhere. I lived there for a time in 1982 when Colombians were fleeing their country's guerrilla violence in pursuit of economic opportunities in their oil-rich neighbor. When I was in graduate school, it was hard to find anyone interested in writing a dissertation on Venezuela. It was too boring. The richest country in South America, everyone saw Venezuela as the land of democracy and prosperity. Today, it is hard to overstate the ruinous state of affairs in Venezuela. In the past several years, we have witnessed not only the destruction of democracy and destruction of an economy, but the destruction of a society, the destruction of a country. It's like having a big hole in South America, close to the United States. If we were to imagine today the most optimistic scenario for Venezuela, it would take at least a generation to recover from the current disaster. To grasp the dimensions of this crisis, look at the facts, which are mind-boggling and staggering by any measure. Since 2015, over 4.5 million Venezuelans, out of a population of roughly 30 million, have fled the country, driven out by the economic and humanitarian crisis. Most have gone to Venezuela's neighbors. The UN Office of Refugees estimates that in 2020, that is, next year, the number could reach well over 6 million, surpassing Syria and becoming the greatest refugee crisis in the world. This is unprecedented in this hemisphere, in our hemisphere. Latin Americans don't have experience in dealing with such extraordinary refugee flows. According to the UN, Colombia alone has received over 1.5 million Venezuelan refugees. Many of the Colombians who went to Venezuela when Venezuela was booming and Colombia was at war, are now coming back to Colombia and fleeing Venezuela. In Peru, where I lived for 4 years, late 80s, early 1990s, nearly 900,000 Venezuelan refugees. In Chile, 400,000. Ecuador, over 300,000. And they go by foot. They walk. If you've seen some of the documentaries about this refugee crisis, they interview some of the Venezuelans who are leaving. And they say, where are you going? He says, I'm walking to Peru. And this appears like something of a different century. It doesn't appear like the 21st century. In some small Caribbean nations close to Venezuela, refugees from that country make up as much as 15% of the total population. And these Caribbean nations are the ones that are least equipped and prepared to deal with this problem. In general, overall, and many experts of similar crises throughout the world have been struck that the region, and especially Colombia, has opened its doors and has been quite generous to the Venezuelans. But as the crisis drags on and refugee flows mount, some countries that are facing economic stagnation and severe fiscal problems have adopted more restricted measures. There are also some troubling signs of xenophobia in some neighboring countries. Of course, for those who can't or don't want to leave the country, the focus is on survival within Venezuela. There are estimated, according to the UN, estimated 7 million Venezuelans within Venezuela who are in need. The UN has targeted 3 million of them for assistance and support. They are enduring a humanitarian crisis of tremendous proportions. These Venezuelans have to deal with health and education systems that have broken down and shortages of food and other basic goods like toilet paper. Diseases like malaria, tuberculosis, and measles have come back and increased exponentially. The country simply doesn't have money to finance imports of basic goods. Inflation is astronomical. You saw up on the screen the IMF figures. Once you get over 100,000 or 200,000 inflation rate, it really doesn't matter, more or less. That is just the differences are meaningless. The country will contract by 18% this year. It's the worst performance of any country, any economy, since Libya fell into civil war in 2014. It's the worst contraction ever experienced by any country that's not at war. The country has lost half its GDP in the last 5 years. Unemployment over 40%, estimated to surpass 50% in 2020. Venezuela relies on oil for its economy, and the production has plummeted from over 3 billion barrels a day when Hugo Chavez took office in 1999 to less than 1 million barrels today. There's an epidemic of violence, and Venezuela is now considered one of the most murderous countries in the world. There are two big questions that I want to address with you. First is, how did we get to this point? Why is the situation so dire? And the second is, what can we do to help resolve these many crises that Venezuela is suffering? I think it's important to go back to the late 1980s and early 1990s, and the conditions in the country that Hugo Chavez emerged. Massive corruption, political and economic elites were discredited. Venezuela had lost an important share of its national income. This country was not in great shape before Chavez was elected in 1998. He tried to overthrow a democratically elected government in 1992. That coup attempt failed, but then he came back to run through an election and won handily, with over 55% of the vote. His focus was on redistribution and inclusion of those who had been left behind and left out. To his credit, I think, he put his finger on legitimate grievances for the first time. The problem and the tragedy is that he became a despot. And in the name of what he referred to as the Bolivarian Revolution, Chavez concentrated all power, made every decision, took over private enterprise, and particularly in the all-important oil sector, the state-owned enterprise PDVSA, often called the crown jewel of Venezuela's economy. He replaced very skilled and technical and managerial workers with great expertise with Chavez loyalists. Political criteria, not competence, was rewarded. Those people who left back in the early 2000s are now in Houston and in Bogota, working in the oil sector in this country as well as in Colombia. Over time, Chavez became more radical, more belligerent, and authoritarian. He was very shrewd in removing any challenges to his power and getting control of the armed forces. He himself was a lieutenant colonel in the armed forces. He was also very lucky. When he took office in 1999, oil was under $10 a barrel. The price skyrocketed, reaching its height in 2006-2007 of over $140 a barrel. In this way, Venezuela had a bonanza, a boom, a party. There was money for social programs, but there was also money to support allies, the Caribbean countries, to understand why they continue to be reluctant to criticize Maduro and the regime. They received very, very generous terms of oil during the Chavez years, when oil prices were so high and they don't produce any oil. And he created this project called Petrocaribe. So many of those countries still feel a huge debt to Venezuela, despite being very troubled by its deterioration. There was massive corruption in Venezuela, mismanagement, and I think above all, if one had to sort of isolate, the key factor is sheer incompetence. When you have people without expertise and only political loyalty, the country decays. Chavez died of cancer in 2013, and his handpicked successor was Nicolas Maduro, who was the vice president at that time. He had been the foreign minister. He was even the president of the Congress. Maduro lacked three things that Chavez had: charisma, political skill, and most of all, money. Chavez's death in 2013 coincided with a sharp drop in oil prices, which has had a huge effect on the Venezuelan economy. Under Maduro, the crises have accelerated and repression has increased, reflected in a recent scathing report by the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, the former Chilean president, Michelle Bachelet, who documents over 300 political prisoners, torture, extrajudicial executions, and other very, very grave human rights abuses. 80% of Venezuelans want a change of government. Maduro is immensely unpopular. Current polls have him about 13% support. So what keeps him in power? The country's a shambles and he's unpopular. Mainly the high brass, the upper echelons of the military, who have stuck with him so far. Many lower level military officers have been jailed for being suspected of betraying Maduro. There are currently 100 military officers in jail. This obviously instills enormous fear. So that's the first reason. Second, this is not only an authoritarian government or dictatorship, but one engaged in widespread criminality. It serves as a transit point for drug trafficking and other illicit activities. Many of these people who have benefited over the years from this boom and from this illegal trades have an interest in keeping Maduro in power. They have a lot to lose. And finally, for many, there is still, and this doesn't get enough attention in the press, in my view, and I keep telling journalists they should focus more on it, is that there is still, for many, there is still a Bolivarian revolution going on. There's an ideological component for why Maduro is still in power. People don't want to abandon the revolution. Maduro may be at 13%, but Chavez is almost at 60% support in Venezuela. Maduro, of course, also has his allies who are helping him. First and foremost, Cuba. Venezuela and Cuba forged a very close relationship based on the personal chemistry between Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez. That has continued, even though support to Cuba has declined because of the profound crisis, economic crisis in Venezuela. At one point, Venezuela was giving Cuba about 100,000 barrels a day. Now it's down to 35,000 or 40,000 barrels a day. In exchange, Cuba has provided, especially in the last few years, security and intelligence support to Venezuela. If there's one country that has a lot of experience in surviving, it's Cuba. They know how to do it. It's been over almost six decades. Also, China. China lent Venezuela a great deal of money over the years, $65 billion. Today, and Venezuela has paid back most of it, today it owes China $20 billion. And also Russia is very involved and very strongly backing the Maduro regime. They're not only for geopolitical reasons, because Mr. Putin is saying, well, you're in my backyard, Ukraine and elsewhere very close to Russia on our border. We're gonna cause some mischief close to you and make things difficult for the United States. And that's one motivation. The other motivation is also money. They're giving economic support for the oil sector through their own state-owned oil company. Almost a year ago now, in January, there was some optimism and expectations were increased because the very popular opposition leader emerged on the scene. Juan Guaido, 35-year-old president of Venezuela's National Assembly, an assembly that had been elected in December of 2015, that had rotating presidents, and Guaido became president in January. He was recognized by the United States and over 50 governments as president. Since Maduro's is down today, as I said, 13%. At its height, Guaido had almost 60%, according to reliable polling. Unfortunately, however, and I say this because attempts at trying to move towards a democratic transition have not worked out. And according to the latest poll just out yesterday, he is down to some 38% support. The strategy that he pursued with the support of the United States and the Trump administration and the rest of the opposition simply didn't work out. The idea was, if you bring a lot of people to the streets, which Guaido was able to do in January and February of last year, the military would see the writing on the wall and would abandon Maduro and join Guaido. That simply has not happened. So what are the options today? In August of 2017, standing next to UN Ambassador Nikki Haley on one side and then Secretary of State Rex Tillerson on the other, to their surprise, President Trump said, all options are on the table. The implication was that a military option was being seriously considered. But there was no appetite for this in any country in Latin America. And Venezuela, unlike other countries like Panama, where the US has gone in, is a completely different scale. 2,000 generals are in Venezuela. There are also guerrilla groups from Colombia that operate from Venezuela. There are also what's called, in Spanish, colectivos, or vigilante groups, that drive around in motorcycles and that are armed. This is not a question of going in and going out in a nice, clean, tidy way. This would require any military option, would require that the US would have to be committed to the country. And there's simply no appetite for that in the United States, and no other country wants to do this either. What's the policy right now? Well, diplomatic isolation and sanctions. Sanctions that were started under President Obama, individual sanctions to people who were guilty of human rights abuses and corruption. So assets were frozen, people weren't restricted in their movements and flying about. And then of last January, the Trump administration not only expanded those individual sanctions, but went to what used to be called the nuclear option in Venezuela, which are economic sanctions and sectoral sanctions, that the US would not buy Venezuelan oil, and they would come down on any third country that dealt with Venezuela. The idea was that this would be absolutely intolerable for the Maduro regime. It would be too much and would lead to the collapse of the government. That was the argument. But it hasn't happened. The big debate today in Washington, one of the big debates about US policy, is to what extent have these economic sanctions, which have led to a deterioration in Venezuela, economically, because they're working, they're aimed at hurting the economy, and they're hurting the economy. To what extent do those sanctions contribute and make worse and aggravate an already critical humanitarian conditions? There are those who argue that the United States should pull back on those sanctions because it is not responsible for. Maduro is responsible, and Chavez is responsible. It goes way back. But by these sanctions are making the situation worse. And there are others who argue, no, we just need more time. The government's got to feel it, and then we'll eventually achieve our objective, and the government will fall. That's a big debate today among analysts of Venezuela. Third option is one of a negotiated solution, which has been tried in 2016, 2017, 2018, and most recently in a process that was started by Norway called the Oslo Talks, first in Norway, then in Barbados, between representatives of the Maduro government and representatives of Juan Guaido. But those talks broke down as well. There's currently an effort to get them restarted, but there's enormous skepticism that they'll be any more successful, and that they'll work. No one can predict when there will be a change in the regime to move towards a democratic order and democratic rule. Some believe it's imminent. If you talk to some experts, you say Maduro can't survive. Of course, they've been underestimating him since he took over from Chavez in March of 2013. How many people said then his days are numbered? And here we are, December 2019, and there's no sense that he's not in complete control. Others predict that this is going to last for a long time, like Cuba. Why not? It's still an oil producer. It's destroyed. But does that is the destruction of the economy necessarily mean that Maduro is finished? Not necessarily. He's not being hurt by the sanctions. The people that are around him in the government are not being hurt by the sanctions. So maybe he can hang on. And then he has this escape valve of all of these Venezuelans that are fleeing, which is pretty much what Fidel Castro did in Cuba in the early 60s. Some people predict that. So it's hard to know what's going to happen. So since it's hard to know and since it's so uncertain, it's probably best to focus on relieving the humanitarian crisis in Venezuela and the refugee crisis in neighboring countries. The problem is that even though governments recognize Juan Guaido as the interim president of Venezuela, Maduro controls all the territory in Venezuela. And he wants to work with partners that he trusts. This has raised a fundamental dilemma with the United Nations. There have been recent articles about this. There's a desire for the United Nations to work with the Maduro government for electrical grid, to build an electrical grid. There's also efforts to try to get massive food, medicine into Venezuela. What's the reaction of the opposition? Well, if the opposition says, that's great. They're supporting the people who are starving, who are miserable and suffering, but they're also legitimizing the Maduro government because they're working with the Maduro government and may even help the Maduro government. They're doing something to help the economy and help people stay there. And they don't want to do that. Strategy is to weaken the government. If they say no, we're against that, they're saying, how could you be against helping starving people from your own country and having them survive? So this is a dilemma that is in conversations that go on within the opposition. What have been the aid levels so far? Well, refugees, there have been, aid levels have been 738 million in the UN. That was the projected for the plan for refugees. That's how much is needed. And less than 25% has been fulfilled of that number. There's a lot of organizations like the World Bank, the Inter-American Development Bank in Washington, non-governmental organizations that are also working on the humanitarian crisis. It would estimate the cost of helping people to be $223 million. 74% of that has not been spent. So basically, there's been some, if you ask how much humanitarian aid has gone to Venezuela and how much humanitarian aid has gone to countries that are struggling to deal with the influx of Venezuelan refugees, the answer is some, but certainly not enough. And it's interesting to reflect a little bit on the comparison with Syria, with Syrian refugees, which received $17 billion over the course of a decade. So a lot more can, should, and must be done to help Venezuelans outside and also inside. What else could the Trump administration do? Well, there's something called temporary protection status. And so far, Venezuelan refugees in the United States don't enjoy the protection status. And the Venezuelans are today over 30% of all the refugee claims in the United States. But there's a reluctance to grant temporary protection status even to Venezuelans, who the administration is clearly in solidarity with because they're leaving a terrible situation, because it would send a sign of greater openness about immigration. and it would run contrary to the spirit and to the decisions that I'd be making on restricting immigration to this country. So we've seen these terrible natural disasters in Latin America. All of you have seen these, the earthquake in Haiti and other natural disasters, which have been terrible. And we've seen a lot of bloody civil wars in Latin America, in Colombia, and then in the 1980s in Central America, in Guatemala and El Salvador. But I don't think we've seen anything like this, of quite the dimensions and proportions of Venezuela. So all of us, I think, need to heed Reston's observation and call to not only read about Latin America and understand what's going on and what's at stake for a country like Venezuela, but also do whatever we can to support those who are suffering terribly as a result of this authoritarian and criminal regime, but one that still has the largest oil reserves in the world. This is an unprecedented nightmare. I've been following Latin America, studying Latin America, working on Latin America since the late 1970s, and I've never seen anything like this. So I am sorry to end on a fairly depressing note. I wish I had better news to report, but we're at a moment, and I think if I had been speaking here a couple of months ago, I may have been more hopeful. The Oslo process was going on. They actually got pretty far, and as I understand it from the Norwegians, that they actually got pretty far in agreeing to certain things, in agreeing to looking at an election, a presidential election. One of the sticking points, whether Maduro can run or not run. What happens to Maduro? For the United States, it's not negotiable. Maduro has to be out. But for some of the opposition thought that, well, realistically, we can't necessarily insist on that. So there was something happening. But it didn't materialize. National Security Advisor John Bolton gave a speech in Lima, Peru, that was very, very tough and increased and announced new sanctions against the Venezuelan regime. And Maduro felt that that was not in the spirit of the negotiation climate, and the talks broke down on both sides. So we're now at a moment when there's pretty much of a stalemate. Many Venezuelans are in other countries. Many National Assembly leaders are in Washington, D.C. I speak with them regularly. Guaido has named an ambassador to the White House. He's named an ambassador to the Organization of American States. He has done what he can to set up a parallel government. But so far, Maduro has the loyalty of the upper echelons of the military, and he still controls territory. And all the bureaucracies in Venezuela are still under Maduro. So that's the reality. And as much as one might hope that that would change, so far it hasn't. So I think we should have learned our lesson not to be naive and unrealistic and engage in a lot of wishful thinking, which I think a lot of people were guilty of, January, February, March, and I was a witness to that wishful thinking. There was great joy in Washington. There was a sense that this was over. Finally, you had this National Assembly, young, popular leader who could bring out millions of people to the streets, and the rest would take care of itself. Well, I think we have to be much more realistic moving forward. The armed forces continue to be the key obstacle in any kind of future negotiation. It seems to me that other countries also have to be at the table. China, Russia, Cuba, the United States. Venezuela has become a piece on the geopolitical chessboard, the global geopolitical chessboard. And so it's become not just a national problem, not just a regional crisis, but I think a global challenge and problem as well. So thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to your questions. Thank you so much.